things. A deep dive study does not mean we're going to be in this book for a year and a half. We're going to be in this for maybe 9 to 12 weeks, something in that area. But we're going to just march through the chapters together. So this is not going to be a terribly complicated study. It's going to be only as complicated as it needs to be to unpack what Ecclesiastes is saying. It's a deep dive in the sense of we're just going to pay special attention to what the text says in a section-by-section kind of way. And the way we'll do it is we'll read it together. You know, for example, like verses 1 through 11 of chapter 1, I'll give some thoughts about what I think this is talking about, and then I'll open it up for you to chime in so that you can have your questions addressed by the group, or comments that you want to make, things that you observe about the text that maybe we didn't talk about. So I think we'll have some fun with this. This is a wonderful book to study. Ecclesiastes is just great. A lot of good things in here. So we'll start with some intro stuff and then get into chapter 1 tonight, Lord willing, but let's begin with prayer. So if you would bow with me, please. Our Almighty God, you are our Maker. You are the one who has redeemed us, and it is to you that we lift our voices and our hearts tonight. We are thankful for each other. We're thankful for this congregation of your people. We're thankful for all the opportunities you give us to be lights in this extremely dark world. We are thankful for the brightness of your Son. We pray that that he would come even more deeply into our hearts and lives this week. Please help your light to be clear to us so that it can be clear through our lives to others. We are thankful for this time together, for this study. We're thankful for your Son. Through him we pray. Amen. All right, a few things about the book of Ecclesiastes as we start getting into it. Let's talk about the title of the book. Ecclesiastes is not really a word that kind of enters our normal vocabulary, at least not mine. So this is an interesting word. This word is the English form of a Greek word meaning somebody who gets together a bunch of people. Anybody familiar with the Greek word for church? Ekklesia. Ecclesiastes, one who gathers an assembly. So you can see the connection there. And so to some people, if you just read the book of Ecclesiastes, at first glance, it might sound like the morbid ramblings of a cranky old man who's kind of gotten to the end of his life. And he's like, this is just all a bunch of hooey, this life business. But when you look at the title of the book and you look at some more things in the book, it becomes apparent that this guy has great intention and purpose in what he's doing with this letter, with this teaching, that he's not gathering people to complain or gripe, although it might seem that way at first. He's gathering people to teach them about God, teach them about spiritual things, about how we should operate with God in mind. And when you look at Deuteronomy 17, we'll get into the author in just a second, right after this. When you look at Deuteronomy 17, you remember what the kings of Israel were supposed to do with the law of Moses? Yes, exactly. They were supposed to write down a copy of the complete law of Moses and have that with them for their lifetime, for their reign, so that they would learn how to fear the Lord. So that was, theoretically, the kings of Israel were in a good position to become teachers of the Israelites. It wasn't just supposed to be the priests and everybody else who had that job. So who wrote this book, Ecclesiastes? Well, you look at chapter 1, verse 1, and it tells us, and yet it doesn't tell us. But what it does say is the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And so this is some kind of Israelite preacher king from David's family, because Saul never reigned in Jerusalem. So this is obviously David on. And so it's curious that this guy tells us three things about himself, but he does not deliberately tell us his name. That's different from the way that Proverbs opens up. You remember the Proverbs chapter 1, verse 1, is very clear about who that author is. So the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. So you can see some similarities in the language, but Ecclesiastes is deliberately anonymous. And so there are three possibilities for who the author is. I'm not going to go into the weeds on this, but I do want to just throw it out there for you to consider. I think that probably the name that boils up when we think about this book, who probably is the author, is Solomon, wisest guy in the scriptures, imbued with all that, clearly did write a lot of the Proverbs, clearly. And so there's a lot of this book that kind of goes in Solomon's direction, but it possibly could be a different king of Judah who came later. Possibly it's an Israelite teacher who uses a Solomon-like personality. I think it's probably Solomon. I think for the purpose of this class, I'm comfortable calling this a book from Solomon. But ultimately, we don't know. And so what he does call himself, though, is what? The preacher. Yes. I think that's interesting. Throughout the book, he calls himself the preacher. It doesn't just appear in chapter 1, verse 1 and verse 2. There are a total of, I counted, 7 different times in this book where he says, I, the preacher, did this, or I thought this, or something happened. And so this is, yeah, the Hebrew word is one who calls together and instructs the assembly. And so the title of the book is directly connected to the word of that's used to talk about this guy. And so throughout this study, that's how I'm going to be referring to the author, is the preacher. Now, notice something interesting. Well, first, let's talk about the preacher for a second. What do preachers do? Okay, they do preach. And why does a preacher preach? What is the intention behind preaching? Okay, so to share news, and okay, so structure, and what is that news designed to do in the audience that is receiving that instruction? Yes. So a preacher informs, here's what the text says, here's what it means. But the preacher is also trying to have the word, the message, shape the audience so that people's lives and thoughts go in a different direction or a better direction than before. And the preachers also, good preachers, are trying to do that to themselves as well, not just everybody else. And so this is what he's trying to do to us as we read this book, is he's preaching to us. He's trying to change us. Trying to change our perspective on life and persuade us to think differently based on this text that he is preaching here. And so what perspective is he trying to get us to have? Well, notice here in this first verse, what we're told about the preacher is from the perspective of somebody else who's presenting his material to us. So chapter 1, verse 1, the words of the preacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem. It almost sounds like you've got this narrator who is introducing this preacher to us. And then go to the end of the book for a second. Chapter 12, let's look at the last 6 verses of the book. It's like the narrator picking up this voice of somebody else besides, outside of the preacher, who is talking about the preacher to us. And he says in chapter 12, verse 9, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. That obviously sounds like one person in particular from the Old Testament. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son... And then he gets into this fatherly tone here. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. So this, it sounds to me, I'm not going to be dogmatic about this at all, but it sounds to me like this is another voice kind of summing up what the preacher has been saying, but you can take that for whatever it's worth. But clearly, we've got a message here that's designed to change us. And the purpose of this, that I think runs as a thread throughout the whole book, is that life's meaning is only found in fearing the Lord. And so we just read that in chapter 12, where he says, this is the sum of the matter. This is where everything is funneling into fear the Lord. But it's interesting, he drops those breadcrumbs throughout the book. If you go to chapter 3, right after his, there's a time for this and a time for that passage, notice how he says, I perceived in 3:14 that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that, here's the purpose of life, so that people fear before him. And you go to 5:7, there it is again. When dreams increase, words grow many, there is vanity. Another one of his favorite words. But God is the one you must fear. Chapter 8 has another passage on fearing the Lord too. And so this teaches us what this book is doing here. And this is a really helpful perspective to have when you're going through some of these, oh, this is vanity and that's vanity and I tried this and I built that and I enjoyed this pleasure and man, it's just, ugh. You know, all just meaningless and wind. It's important to remember that this is what he's doing, what he's trying to do, even though it sounds depressing on the surface. It's to knock down all of the different idols that people put their trust in and their delight in and their meaning in. Well, it's going to be work. It's going to be sexual pleasure. It's going to be riches. It's going to be this, that, and whatever. And he's saying, I did that. I tried that. I bought that. I built that. But none of it is worth putting your sinking your hopes and dreams into, because at the end of the day, it's just wind. And so he's gonna do a lot of things in this book. He's gonna teach us about the passage of time and death. He's gonna talk about the breakdown of our minds and our bodies, but he doesn't teach us to fear those. Fear the Lord. He's going to talk about time and chance happens to us all, so much of life is outside of our control, but he's not going to teach us to fear those. He's going to keep coming back to this main point throughout the course of this study. We're going to have, even though this future that we live through, you know, at moment to moment in our lives, the next moment is a mystery. What's life going to turn into? We just don't know. And there's going to be twists and turns. But what we do know for certain is that our lives are approaching quickly a meeting with our Creator. We're going to all, each one of us, stand in front of Him and give an account for who we were in this life and what we chose to pursue. And so that's what He's trying to help us to prepare to do. And He's going to teach us that not all of our time of preparation is always going to be pretty. I really appreciate that this book is in the scriptures, because when you read the Proverbs, for the most part, it's a pretty upbeat tone that has to do with, you know, life's going to go well for you if you're righteous. Like if you keep the Lord's commandments, you do what you're supposed to do, things are just going to go well for you. I mean, that's the tone of Proverbs. And if you're wicked, things are not going to go well for you. But Ecclesiastes comes alongside of Proverbs and says, well, yes, those general truths are generally true, but life is kind of complicated under the sun, isn't it? And sometimes you're going to have days where you're doing the right thing, but it may not always turn out well for you, and you need to have the right perspective on that. So Ecclesiastes is just another angle to come at what wisdom means. We live amongst thorns and thistles here, and we've got to be prepared for that. Okay, and real quickly, I think this point needs to be made, even though this might seem like an obvious point to make. When you go to chapter 12, And you go and you look at verse 11, and we already read this together, so I won't read it again. Do you notice how he says that the words of the preacher that we just went through, if we've gone through that part of the book, they're like what? What are they like? They're like goads, and they're like nails firmly fixed, and they're given by who? One shepherd. I think that shepherd's talking about God there. And so what he's saying in the book is, you need to accept that everything that's been said, in contract with, you know, he'll talk about in the next book, he'll talk about all the other books in the world that have no ends. I mean, you go to Barnes & Noble, you go to Amazon.com, you can buy millions of books if you want to. But these are given by one shepherd. These are of divine origin. And that's important because if you're like me, sometimes you move through parts of Ecclesiastes and you think, I don't think that's how life works. I don't think you're a little off on that. What we have to do is we have to grapple with these words and not dismiss them and not treat them as off kilter, off base, because they're given by the shepherd. All right, they're from God. They're not from this guy, and that's different from what normal preachers do, right? Me and any other preacher who gets up and teaches people, we're trying to take the words of God, but we're the ones that are trying to arrange our thoughts from the word and trying to make applications. And so that's why whatever a preacher says here, you need to really carefully examine and cross-reference with what is actually being said from the text, because this is truth. What I say out of my mouth cannot be taken as gospel truth unless it is coming from here. But with this preacher, we've got to take these words and accept them as divine, and weigh them in that kind of way. Okay, and then finally, I really want to make this point. Because before we read about vanity and striving after wind and all of this, we've got to have this path, I think, at the back of our mind. Go to First, go way outside of Ecclesiastes for a minute, and go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I want you to notice something here, and we're getting into Corinthians in Toby's class here pretty quick. What is 1 Corinthians 15 a chapter about? Anybody know, kind of off the top of your head? Okay, the resurrection. Corinthians really struggled with that. They thought there was no bodily resurrection because that's what the Greeks around them thought. And Paul says, well, let me spend a whole chapter, 58 verses, on why you need to correct your really, really wrong attitudes about resurrection because, I'm not going to get into it because that's your class. But what I do want to do is look at the end of the chapter with you, because I think this ties back to Ecclesiastes. Somebody just go ahead and read that if you're there. Verse 58.
Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord.
That your toil is not in vain. All right. Vanity of vanities, vainness, all is vanity is what the continual refrain of the preacher is, Ecclesiastes. But when you broaden this into the larger Bible story that Ecclesiastes fits into, you get this perspective that life is not, this life under the sun really does seem like a hamster on a wheel sometimes, and I'm doing all this stuff. And I get up in the morning and something hurts and I do my work and it doesn't seem to do much. And we just seem like we're not really getting anywhere. But God says when you broaden up the perspective and you put Jesus into the equation, which the Ecclesiastes writers have, right? Paul says your labor is not in vain because of the resurrection of Jesus. And because of that, the resurrection of your body and the eternal life that we're all headed towards. What you do in this life does matter. It matters a lot. And so we've got to just, every time we go through the twists and turns of the book we're going to be studying, I just want you to have that at the back of your head. I think it's going to be helpful for me. I think it's going to be helpful for you as well. Okay. I want to stop there and take a swig of water and ask you if you have comments that you want to make on any of this or questions that you have so far about this intro stuff. All makes perfect sense. If it doesn't, it's okay.
In the very first or the second verse, chapter one,
yeah.
It says vanity of vanities. I mean, he just lays it out.
Yeah.
If you're getting ready to get the full context of what he's talking about, he pulls no punches. He's basically,
yeah.
Not being on the bush, he's telling you, I have been through all of this, I have seen
right.
In your life toiling after these things, it's not going to be net negative.
Yes. And that kind of leads into a couple of the overarching themes that I wanted to hit before we actually get into the text. And that's one of them. I mean, that's what he says right off the bat in verse 2. If we're going to pick a favorite of the preacher, it's probably this word. Because when you look at the end of the book, 12, this is the bookend phrase at the end as well, chapter 12, verse 8. When he's talking about, okay, this is going to happen to your body, and that's going to happen to your body, and that's going to happen to your body, he'll sum it up in verse 8 and say, vanity of vanities, same phrase, says the preacher, all is vanity. And he's going to say this word 30, I counted 37 times in all the book of Ecclesiastes. And this word in the Hebrew is kind of difficult to translate. It's often translated vanity, and you may have that. I've got that in the ESV. But the word vanity in the Hebrew literally means a mist or a breath, a mere breath or vapor, something that's difficult to catch hold of. Can you think of a New Testament passage that talks about our life as a vapor or a mist that appears for a little while and then it's... James chapter 4, you don't know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. I don't know if the Spirit put Ecclesiastes in James's mind as he wrote down those words, but we can cross-reference here and we can see that's exactly what's going on here in the book. So I think the New Testament writers built on these ideas here. And that gets into another phrase that he really likes to use here, this phrase, under the sun. I counted about 26 times that phrase is used here. So the idea of this seems to be, I'm looking around and from my vantage point here, life is broken. And life doesn't work right in the way that it's designed to work. And again, like when you go to Romans 8 and you look at how Paul talks about the creation, I think he builds on this kind of idea when he says that the creation was subjected to futility or vanity, right? In fact, what I didn't even know this before I was studying for this class. But that Greek word for futility in Romans 8 is the same Greek word that's used in the Septuagint version, the Greek translation of the Old Testament for the book of Ecclesiastes, for the word vanity. All that word vanity, he's using the same word from the Greek. So we take this book and we study it because this bleeds into what the gospel writers are going to do with Jesus and his message. Another one that I'll just hit on, we won't go into depth in this, but something that he talks about a lot is the nature of our work here. Work is both frustrating and fulfilling, and there's passages on either side of that. And we know that. You know, when you read Genesis 3, you read the sin of Adam and Eve. I mean, what did God say to Adam when God came into the garden and said, okay, here's your curse, here's the curse, here's the curse. What was Adam's curse? Do you remember? Yeah, Yeah, I mean, he was given work at the very beginning, even before sin, but now the work that I gave you to do is going to be hard. Now you go out to the field, and it's not just going to be roses and tulips and potatoes and whatever else he's going to grow. It's going to be thorns and thistles that you're going to have to root out before you can grow all the things you want to grow. For the woman, you know, you're going to have babies. You were always designed to have babies, but now having babies is going to be harder, and et cetera. So the world is, the work that we have can be satisfying, but it can also be hard. And you see that, like, chapter 2, look at chapter 2, verse 10. So he's talking about things that he acquired and things that he's building and all that. And he says, whatever my eyes, verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. You know, I had a good time. This was fun. And this was my reward for all my toil. But then you get down to verse 18, and he says, almost like in a bipolar kind of way, oh, I hated all my toil, in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who comes after me. Well, dude, which one is it? Did you have fun or did you hate it? Well, it's kind of both sometimes. I mean, can you relate to that experience? You know, you have a good day at work and you come home and you're like, man, that was just great. Everything went well. And then you come back the next day and some coworker is goofing off and just messing things up, and there's thorns and thistles that just erupt over in your field that you got to go deal with, and you know, there's a lot of kind of situations that we deal with that where things just go wrong after they go right. And so this side of heaven, we're not going to find a perfect experience until we get to our rest. And this is what he's doing. He is being intentionally pessimistic, almost, and borderline depressing, not to depress us, but to take away something that's not going to leave us satisfied so that we're going to hunger for something that will. Does that make sense? So he's taking something away from us, but he wants to replace it with something of true joy and value. So that's why this book is important, I think. Even though at first glance it seems like, why are we studying this? But here's where I really want to come down, all right? And I think I was having a conversation with Steve about this earlier. I think this is maybe one of the neglected points of this book, all right? That what the preacher tells us is that the blessings of our lives, even if they're not going to be perfect and there's going to be hard times and vanity and striving after wind and all that, blessings in life should be enjoyed as God's gifts. For example, and there's several scriptures there on the screen that teach this. We'll just go to one of them. Let's go to the chapter 8 one. Chapter 8, verse 15. He says this, and I commend joy. I commend joy. Well, I thought you were talking about how worthless life. No, I commend joy. For man has no good thing under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him, and there's one of his phrases, under the sun. Yes, in a broken world, stuff's going to happen, but you can have joy. There's a lot of good things going on in life. So the preacher is not anti-pleasure, all right? He's not anti-pleasure. There's nothing wrong with taking joy in the good things that we can take enjoyment in. He doesn't want us to elevate those blessings to the status of idolatry. He spends the book making sure that we don't do that. But he does take time to say, but, you know, when you can end your day with Turkey Hill chocolate peanut butter ice cream and you can afford the calories, you should do that. You should take it home and have a good bowl of that and all that sugary goodness. It's great stuff. or, you know, translate that to whatever ice cream you really enjoy. And so what he wants us to do is hold on to our blessings loosely, kind of with an open hand, but to enjoy whatever blessings come to us as they come and go, and blessings will come and go. For example, you know, in the early part of your years, God gives you, generally speaking, healthy bodies that don't hurt and that can do a lot of things. When you have youth and you have energy and you have those blessings, enjoy them. Yeah, no, they're not going to last forever. Yeah, someday you're going to be old. He's going to talk about that. But while you're young, enjoy that. If you have a spouse, enjoy your spouse and that precious relationship. If you've got kids, enjoy your little kids. They're not going to be little forever. Right? Some of you with older kids understand that. If you can take enjoyment in going to Hawaii, you should go to Hawaii. You know, if you could go to Yellowstone and you know, pet some bison, you should go to Yellowstone. Do that. There's just so many wonderful things. A delicious cup of coffee, curling up with a good book while rain is beating against the window, going to Barnes & Noble and getting lost in there. Pleasures abound in this life. And he teaches we should relish those things. So this is, I think, the needed balance in the discussion of this book that sometimes gets overlooked. As long as these blessings are kept in their proper place, they should be enjoyed. Just not taken outside of their proper place. All right? That's what I got for intro stuff. Any more comments or questions before we get into chapter 1? Yeah.
It's also used under heaven. It's also, you can add that sort of to it as well. Because outside of under the sun, in other words, if whatever we're talking about, whatever we're doing, is only under the sun, then it's vain. And I think that's why you see that so often here, is if you're only paying attention to what's under the sun, he weaves in the important stuff there like five times. But wait, what's not under the sun?
Mm-hmm.
God doesn't exist, doesn't reside under the sun. He resides above the sun, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So when you read these things about enjoying life, enjoying these things, recognizing it ain't all going to go your way, it sucks sometimes. It's under the sun. And those phrases will get used to remind us as to where that is. Right at the end, you said something I think really important. The balance is what's not under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
God is not under the sun. He is over all. And that's where we need to be paying the most attention.
Yeah, which is then so staggering when you get to the Gospels and God becomes a human and he comes under the sun. He comes down here where the broken world is. And he becomes one of us, and he experiences what we experience as part of the beauty of the gospel message. So this is laying, as the Bible Project people say, this is creating shelf space for later Bible writers, Bible characters, God himself to come along and fill up that shelf space with on top of what has already been built as a foundation. So that's why we go back and study the Old Testament. And this is a really key part of that. Thank you for that. Mike, did you have a comment too?
How specific can we get to the audience of the author here? Or is it even important to get that specific?
You know, I think if we could nail down exactly who it was who wrote this, I think then we could exactly nail down who he's writing to in the audience. But we're talking about sometime where it's Israel post David, and any time in that Israel like after David. I mean, for some of Solomon's time, it was great. It was really, really great. But like Solomon's son was a bozo, Rehoboam. I mean, to put it mildly. And the kingdom divided, and so some Israelites aren't even anymore, and the north quickly spirals down. And the South does okay, but they eventually spiral down too. And so I think if you're an Israelite living during the reign of any of, regardless of where we want to put this, in this timeline era, you're looking at a lot of injustice in your society. You're looking at a lot of things that you wish you could fix. And in fact, he'll talk about, I think it's even in this first chapter, if you look down at, verse 15, notice what he says, what is crooked, chapter 1, verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. So I think at a broad society level, I think the preacher and the Israelites that he's with are that at every stage of government, people are not listening to the prophets. The prophets are coming in droves during the days of the kings. Hey, we're not doing the law. We're worshiping idols. We got to get back to God. And they're just blowing off the prophets, and they're killing them and persecuting them. And so it's a rough time in some ways to be an Israelite, regardless of exactly where we put this. But that's a good question to try to think about. What are they experiencing right now that this would speak to? And so they're feeling a lot of vanity, striving after wind. So thank you. Anybody else before we start chapter 1? Okay. Chapter 1. Can I get somebody to read 1 through 11 for us, please? Ty, you got that?
The words of the preacher, the son of David, the king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north, and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after.
Okay, thank you. So just looking at 1 through 3 for a second. So vanity of vanities, and this has been, I may have mentioned this before when we were in Isaiah 6 several weeks, months ago. The Hebrews didn't have, as far as I can tell, superlatives in their language. Big, bigger, biggest, for example, like we have in English. And so they just repeated words to show increasing emphasis. So holy of holies, right? For the innermost part of the temple or the tabernacle. So vanity of vanities, and then even he piles on after that to say, in case you didn't hear my message, all is vanity. This is just the strongest possible way for him to say what he's saying there about the state of life under the sun. And so in verse 3, the question that he asks there, what does man gain by all the toil which he toils under the sun? He'll ask that question in some form or fashion 5 other times in the book. And if you're taking notes, that's chapter 3, verse 9, chapter 5, verse 15, chapter 2, verse 11, chapter 6, 11, chapter 10, verse 11. What does he gain? So he's, again, trying to detach us from a hunger of the world so we'll hunger for something else. So if this life is your desire and your hope, then you're just going to be spinning your wheels. That's his basic thesis. He'll just develop that throughout the whole rest of the book. Now, verses 4 through 11, he's going to give us a list of the kinds of things that we can run around on the hamster wheel with. So verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. I'm kind of a quirky person in some ways, and I like walking around in graveyards. Anybody else like walking around in graveyards? Especially really old graveyards. Back where we lived in the Northeast, where you guys are about to go, so maybe you can see some of these. In Boston, there are some really old graveyards that go back to like 1600s, and the stones are amazing to just walk around and read. And but it's kind of a humbling, sobering thought to make that walk, because you're looking down at Ebenezer something or rather, and you're thinking, man, Ebenezer had a whole personality and likes and dislikes and a family and you know, he had a life here, and now I don't know anything about this Ebenezer, and nobody else around me does. he's a name on a stone, and maybe there's a couple of things on Ancestry.com that you could find about it hard enough, but he's mostly just there now. And so it's sobering to realize, you know, one day that's going to be me. That's going to be me, and that's going to be you. That's humbling. In some ways, that's depressing. But you know why that's good to realize that? It keeps our heads on straight, doesn't it? Just speaking as a preacher, something that preachers sometimes struggle with is wanting to get their name out there and wanting people to know about them. But, you know, everybody needs to realize, whether you're a preacher or not, is even if people know your name, in 100 years, nobody's going to know your name. So why do you work so hard at trying to get a good reputation and get people's pats on the back when that is striving after wind? Because what is vapor? What is mist? What is breath? Like, you know, we live in a part of the country where you can see your breath in the wintertime. If you do that and you try to grab hold of it, you just can't get there. You can't grasp it. It's not there. Well, that's what he's doing with verse 4 and with the verses that follow from this is keep your head on straight. Don't focus on yourself. Don't focus on trying to be a Julius Caesar and get the world to worship you. That's not going to happen because you're going to die anyway. Focus on what you're supposed to be focusing on. Fearing the Lord is, again, what this all goes down to. So there's verse 4, but then he's going to go into these other interesting cycles here. So we'll talk about the wind in verse 6. And since he's already talking about striving after wind anyway throughout the book, it's interesting that he does that again there in verse 6. It blows around, goes to the south or to the north, it runs around this way and that way. And around here, boy, we have wind. We didn't have this much wind in the Northeast, so kind of a new experience for me. So it goes around, and you can't say, oh, it'll never come around again. No, it's going to come around again. Verse 7, you got the water cycle. All streams run to the sea. Sea's not full. And the stream place where the streams flow, there they flow again. The water just goes around and around. You got physical senses that never get filled up. Verse 8, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. You know, do you ever watch a really good movie like the original Lord of the Rings trilogy? For me, it's going to be different for you, but for me, it's like, oh man, the epic battle scenes and hobbits and wizards, and it's just a great story. Books even better. But the movie's wonderful. But do you ever watch a really good movie and think, oh man, I'm good. I never need to see a movie ever again. I'm not going to hanker for that. That has just perfectly sated my desire for entertainment. No, we don't say that. Next week runs around Friday night. Okay, what are we watching now? Because the eye's not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. Anybody like music? I love music, listening to music. I listen to music almost every day when I'm in my office or I'm running around town or whatever, because I listen to something, oh, that was great, but then I want to listen to something else. That's just the way that life runs. Experiences, verses 9 and 10, what has been is what will be, what has been done will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it is said, see, this is new? No, nobody says that. It's already been in the ages before us. Now, wait a minute. Did they have computers in Solomon's day, or whoever wrote this? Did they have airplanes? Did they have, you know, automobiles? No. So how can he say that there is nothing new under the sun? I think there's, you know, a lot of things that are new under the sun. Or what's the point here? Okay, yeah, so who we are doesn't ever change. But even with an airplane, if you think about that, what does an airplane do? It just takes people from point A to point B. Have there been ways to take people from point A to point B throughout the millennia of human existence? Yeah. Maybe they, talking donkeys. There you go. Or chariots. Somebody said chariots, camels, horses, walking. You know, your legs, right? There have been lots of ways to do that. So the airplane, even though it's new technology, it's actually not a new concept. It just helps us do what we've always been doing a little bit quicker, sometimes a lot quicker than what we've been doing before. Computers, automobiles, I mean, anything that you could point to in our technological age is not actually new, if you really boil it down and think about it. So I think he's right here. I don't think we can disprove that. And so verse 11, there's no remembrance of former things. There will be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after. This is his sum up verse. And this is, again, just his way of trying to point us to the fear of the Lord instead of trying to find satisfaction in anything else. All right. Any more comments or questions on 1 through 11 before we get into the last part of chapter 1? Can I get somebody to read the rest of the chapter, 12 through 18, for us? Thank you, Dee. Appreciate it.
I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realized that this also is striving after wind. Because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain.
Okay, so the preacher is going to go on this experimental mission. And I think it's interesting in verse 12 that, I mean, he basically tells us the same thing that he told us in the first verse, but he's going to say it again. Just want to let y'all know, I'm not just, you know, a run-of-the-mill preacher. I'm a king who's also a preacher. So that tells us he's got the resources and he's got the clout to run whatever kind of experiments on life that he wants to run. So anything that you and I could think about wanting to do with life, he says, I'm at the top of the totem pole, and I tried to do all of it. So believe me when I tell you what I've found out. So he's going to tell us about the fact that he's going to go on this mission. But even before he tells us about the kind of experiments that he runs, I mean, that's going to be chapter 2 and on, mostly chapter 2, he's going to tell us his methodology, and he's going to tell us his test results before he goes on to talk about his experiments. So what are his methods? Well, verse 12, he's a king, so he's going to use his kingness and and all the things that come with that. But what else is he going to use in order to run these experiments? Okay, yeah, his mind. He tells us here that he uses wisdom. He uses wisdom in order to test the limits of wisdom and madness and folly. But he's not going to go hog wild. He's not going to just you know, make a bunch of orgies in his week and call it a day. He's going to use wisdom to do all these things. And verse 13, he's going to be very thorough in this. All that is done under heaven. Verse 14, I've seen everything that is done under the sun. And then what are his test results? What is he going to conclude as he runs all these experiments? Yes, yes. So verse 14, verse 17, he uses the same phrase, behold, all is vanity. And specifically this phrase, striving after wind. And so the world isn't fixable by us. That's important heading into this political season, because what is every single politician, at least in America, seemingly, what does every single politician want to say to get themselves elected by you? Oh man, if you just vote me into office, I'm going to go into this and I'm going to go into that and I'm just going to clean it all up. And I'm just going to, I'll be the best of the best. And then you vote him into office and okay, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years gone by. What have you actually done that makes my life dramatically different? No, the same corruption I see is happening, the same this, the same that. You really haven't fixed all the things that you claimed you were going to fix. So that's just so helpful for us to keep in the back of our minds as we go to the ballot box. Let us never, ever think that a human being other than Jesus of Nazareth is going to be our Savior. I mean, it's just not going to happen. We have a spiritual kingdom that is ruled by a wonderful king who actually does fundamentally fix the problem of sin. But these politicians that sit in oval offices or houses of Congress or even the Supreme Court building, they don't fix ultimately what is broken like God can. And so this is really important kind of sum up area here of the book. The world isn't fixable by us, and this is the way that life is. And so acquiring more wisdom and knowledge, it just kind of increases your knowledge of how broken the world is. Verse 18, for in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. You know, but we live in a culture that preaches, oh, you should just be able to know everything, right? I mean, Google, get those news articles, get all that information about what's happening everywhere. I'd say sometimes I just have to put down the news app and just leave it alone for days at a time sometimes, because you read about, you get knowledge on what's happening in all these foreign countries. There's famine, there's war, there's pillaging and plundering happening in Ukraine. I mean, it's just terrible things are happening in the world. I don't think the human mind is designed to just feed on that in its entirety, because there's not much we can do about that individually. We can pray about it, but we are meant to be at the ground level with the people and the humans around us, doing whatever we can for God's glory. So if you increase knowledge, you can do that in our culture. You can increase knowledge in a lot of ways, but be thoughtful about why you're doing that, how you're doing that, whether that's actually helpful for you to do. This is something he's going to return to at the end of the book as well. If you go to chapter 12, verse 12, and we read this already. When I was in college, we used this verse as an excuse to not study, where he says, in chapter 12, verse 12, of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. There it is. So if you ever, and Heidi, you're in textbooks right now, right? So if you want an excuse to not do that, then there it is. You can go to Luke, like, here's a date night. Because Ecclesiastes 12:12, there it is. I'm kidding. That's right. Yep. I think my parents use it too. So it's not, there's nothing new under the sun, right, when it comes to using Bible passages out of context. And with that, that's what I've got tonight. Any more comments or questions from anybody before we start to wrap it up tonight?
Our mother in Florida used to say that the hairs of your head are all numbers, so have your numbers cut by 5 o'clock on Friday.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good. All right. Well, this has been a delight to be with you tonight. Let's close with a word of prayer. Brent, can I ask you to stand for us?
Our gracious Father, you provide more than what we need. You've given us life here, and you have given us words of wisdom like we read here from the preacher that help us to understand there is more to it than just what here is in the physical nature. But you have given us a life that is meant to serve you. It's meant to glorify you in our actions, in our thoughts, in the way we live. And so we take these words of wisdom, help them to ring true so that we can be aware of these distractions and things in life that can distract us. But we're also very thankful for these good things that you have provided us. You are a good and giving God that has blessed us beyond measure. And we are most grateful to you for the gift of life through your Son, the gift that we ultimately see is beyond measure. We are grateful for Christ. We are grateful for his sacrifice, his teachings, and his example of obedience. Help us to follow that all the days of our life. In Christ's name we pray.
Next Sunday afternoon. I'm not for sure about that yet, so keep. Oh, yes, thank you. Forgot about that completely.